This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld cracked the war whip in Congress today. His testimony in front of the House Armed Services Committee presented a stark laundry list of reasons for a first strike against Saddam Hussein. A unique threat to the U.S., Rumsfeld said. The most aggressive living dictator on the planet. A despot with weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. must strike first and strike hard, Rumsfeld said. Inspections aren't enough. The goal is disarmament. Congress must vote for a war on Iraq now before the U.N., he said, to show the world it's serious. If America waits for a smoking gun in Baghdad, it's already too late. This hour, On Point, the Bush administration takes its case on Iraq to Congress. Should Congress give the White House a green light for war? Have we had enough debate? Too much debate? Are you ready for war with Iraq? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us in the studio tonight is Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and author of Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Van Evra.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. Also with us in the studio tonight is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, and good to have you right here, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be with you, Steve.
Stephen Van Evra, Jack Beatty, let's get right to it. Donald Rumsfeld testified in front of the House Armed Services Committee and told Congress that it must vote on Iraq before the U.N. does. Let's listen to a clip of Rumsfeld's call for congressional action.
The president has asked members of the House and the Senate to support actions that may be necessary to deliver on that pledge. He urged that the Congress act before the recess. He asked that you send a clear signal to the world community and to the Iraqi regime that our country is united in purpose and prepared to act. It's important that Congress send that message before the UN Security Council votes. Delaying a vote in Congress would send the wrong message, in my view, just as we are asking the international community to take a stand and as we are cautioning the Iraqi regime to respond and consider its options.
Donald Rumsfeld today in front of the House Armed Services Committee. Stephen Van Evra, I'm getting a little seasick or whiplash feeling here. Gung-ho to war before the UN. Iraq offers inspections and everything seems to pause. Today, full speed ahead again. Pedal to the floor in Washington. President Bush asking for action before the congressional recess. Donald Rumsfeld asking for a green light before the UN Security Council votes on something. And I'm reading in the wire services today that that could be as early as next week. Are we talking about 2 days of hearings and, boom, Congress votes for war if necessary?
That's what the Bush people want. They've decided that war is the only solution to the Saddam problem and that inspections will get us nowhere. And I think inspections, in fact, they're right about that. The inspection regime isn't going to solve the weapons of mass destruction problem in Iraq.
So is it binary? If inspections won't work, does that mean war is necessary?
No. The key question that we still have to answer is, are there other ways of dealing with this problem? Do we have an alternative? Will containment work? Can we continue to contain Saddam? I think their political tactic is intelligent. It's true that we will get wider cooperation around the world the more the rest of the world thinks we are committed to war. Some countries around the world have already fallen in line because they've come to the view that, you know, Bush means business, we are going to war, and they'd rather be on our side than annoying us from the sidelines. And to have Congress, in addition, vote a resolution will add to that sense of momentum, and it will help us line up other countries. So from a sort of political tactics point of view, mm-hmm. this is a smart thing to do. But it still leaves the question open whether war is the right answer to the problem that Saddam poses.
So this is coalition building with a crowbar or with sharp spurs. We are just pushing this horse forward.
Yes. But I think it's smart tactics. Mm-hmm. If you're committed mm-hmm. to war, that's how I'd play it.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, the congressional leadership coming out of a meeting with President Bush before the hearings or almost simultaneously this morning came out in a very supportive mood. Tom Daschle saying,
we're on board, and we will help the president get this before the recess, which is coming up before long. We have 2 days of hearings scheduled here. Congress stamped its feet and insisted on them, but it's hardly looking like a major roadblock or necessarily even a deep debate about the war.
No, Senator Daschle did say that what the resolution, he said the real question is what the resolution will say. And one of the things it might say.
This is the UN Resolution Security Council?
No, this is the resolution that the Congress will vote on. And some Democrats, according to the Washington Post, want to limit, want to make congressional approval of war contingent on UN approval. That's sort of building in a break. In advance of the UN vote. Now, whether that will be sustained or not, I don't know. But there does seem to be a kind of hedge there. We're for war if the UN is. And then that puts things on the UN. It gives the president his bargaining chip. We're ready to go to war, but not quite the one that he may have wanted. Now, if the Democrats can make a fight over that, I think they have public opinion with them. According to a poll from CNN last night, only 35% of the people favor war without the UN support. So I think they could actually make a pretty good stand on principle here.
And yet that's a long way in tenor from what Donald Rumsfeld seemed to be asking for today. He's saying we need a green light. He's saying in tenor, don't put conditions on this. Do you see the spine in Congress or the inclination, Steve Van Evere, to require the White House to have the UN on board before military action?
I think that Bush is going to get his way with Congress in the end. If you look at history, whenever presidents have stuck their own reputations on the line and asked for congressional approval, they wound up being able to get it. And the case that Saddam is a danger or a problem is a strong case. And I think the case for caution is a complicated one, and it's going to get lost in the weeds if the Bush people want to push Congress to a quick decision. I still think it's very unwise to do that. I want to see a much longer congressional deliberation and much more hearings, because this is a very complex and dangerous war we're launching here, and a lot of questions haven't been answered yet. The most important one that hasn't been answered is the aftermath. How are we going to cope with Iraq after we've occupied it? We're talking here, we use the euphemism regime change here. What we're talking about is conquest and occupation. And I haven't seen the scenario for us getting out of this country.
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back and talk about the aftermath, but I want to get a little more sense first of Donald Rumsfeld's push before the House Armed Services Committee today. One thing that did not take too long to deal with was this question of whether or not preemptive action might be necessary. Rumsfeld was very clear that the times have changed, that the old days when we had to have evidence first, that we had to even have a strike first by the other, are history. It's too late for that. It's time to look at things in a new way. Donald Rumsfeld before the House Armed Services Committee today.
In our country, it's been customary to seek evidence that would prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law. That approach, of course, is appropriate when the objective is to protect the rights of the accused. But in the age of weapons of mass destruction, the objective is not to protect the rights of a Saddam Hussein. It's to protect the lives of the American people and our friends and allies. And when there is that risk, and we're trying to defend against closed societies and shadowy terrorist networks, expecting to find that standard of evidence before such a weapon has been used is really not realistic. And after such a weapon has been used, it's too late. I suggest that any who insist on perfect evidence really are thinking back in the 20th century in a pre-9/11 context.
Donald Rumsfeld today putting congressmen on notice that if they asked too much about evidence, they were living in a pre-9/11 world. Jack Beatty, that's not any place that any congressman wants to be seen as living once it's framed that way.
No. The secretary, when he's been asked in the past, what about connection between the Iraqi regime and al-Qaeda, has come down with a kind of haiku. He says the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. And maybe I've got that wrong. But he does this sort of sleight of hand on that central question. And, of course, that question has never been answered. It's been answered as far as it has been, that is, the connection between the Iraqi regime and al-Qaeda. There doesn't seem to have been a connection established, nothing that our intelligence sources can say. And moreover, Rumsfeld's history with evidence, just as a piece of background, is interesting. I mean, when he was Secretary of Defense the first time, the CIA came up with a report on the Russian military. He didn't think it was sufficiently tough, and he commissioned another team of hawks, people like Richard Perle, I think, and Wolfowitz, and Team B did their own estimate of the Soviet Union. What they did there was they reasoned from the capabilities of the Soviet Union to its intentions, and they vastly overstated the capabilities and darkened the intentions. So that if you were to look at this Team B report against what we know about the Soviet military subsequently, you could see that it was a vast exaggeration. Similarly, when he repeated this with missile defense in the 90s, Rumsfeld led a commission that essentially took the CIA estimate about when we would need missile defense against Iraq or North Korea and said, no, that's not enough. We don't. And they did their own report, which, again, magnified beyond any evidence that people could see the danger and the imminence of the danger from missile attack from other people. So his whole way with evidence has been very breezy, to put it mildly.
He was not shy before the House Armed Services Committee today. Let's listen to Donald Rumsfeld's list of particulars in the complaints against Saddam Hussein.
No other living dictator matches Saddam Hussein's record of waging aggressive war against his neighbors, pursuing weapons of mass destruction, using them against his own people, launching missiles against his neighbors, brutalizing and torturing his own citizens, harboring terrorist networks, engaging in terrorist acts, including the attempted assassination of foreign officials, violating international commitments, lying and hiding his WMD programs from inspectors, deceiving and defying the express will of the United Nations over and over again. As the President told the United Nations, in one place, in one regime, we find all of these dangers in their most lethal and aggressive forms.
Donald Rumsfeld today, as he pushed the Congress to vote quickly on a resolution that would give a green light to military action in Iraq, to give that resolution and pass it before the UN Security Council acts. Is it time, listeners, for Congress to vote yay or nay on war with Iraq? Have we had a proper debate on war with Iraq? Too much? Too little? Are you ready for war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve Vanevra, as you listen to that bill of particulars, and now we've begun to hear it as a kind of a chant that we're familiar with, but it is long and it's not pretty, and is it time?
Well, I think his bill of particulars is accurate as to what kind of fellow Saddam is, but wrong in claiming that Saddam is unique. We've seen plenty of dictators over the last 60 years who fit the picture he painted of Saddam, starting with Stalin. If you want to talk about a serial aggressor, someone who sought weapons of mass destruction, mass murdered his own people, Mao Zedong, about whom people in the early 60s argued was irrational. And there were some columnists in this country who called for preventive war against China based on the notion that the Chinese were crazy enough to plant bombs in our own cities. And today we have a number of thugs around the world who I think are in the same class with Saddam and worse in certain ways. The Syrians and the Iranians have been more involved with terror than Iraq
has. The Bush administration speaks as though it's willing to take on all comers if this issue of the threat of weapons of mass destruction delivered overtly or covertly comes into play. Donald Rumsfeld says, Stephen Ever, you may be thinking in a pre-9/11 way that weapons of mass destruction changed the equation, the accessibility of them, the ability to deliver, the ability to pull off 9/11 or something worse. Does that make us face a different world than we did in the time of Stalin or Mao Zedong?
I think we face a very different world, but I think the danger we face is from Al-Qaeda. That's the great bell ringer. We should wake up to the danger that non-state actors, sophisticated terrorist outfits like Al-Qaeda pose a fundamental threat to us, which I think they do. And the real question Rumsfeld has to answer is, will a war on Iraq distract us from the war on Al-Qaeda? Will it hamper that war in any way? Will it ease Al-Qaeda's efforts to injure us in any way? Some people believe that Al-Qaeda's strategy in the Mideast was to suck us into some kind of offensive lunge into the Mideast that they then could use as a rallying cry, a beanbag to beat, to mobilize the Muslim world to support in the end al-Qaeda's dream of, you know, returning it to some pure Islam of the 7th century. And here we are proposing to do exactly what some people think al-Qaeda hoped to do on 9/11, which is to provoke us into some kind of imperial lunge into the Muslim world.
But Rumsfeld said today, going after Iraq is part of the war on terror, is, even if by indirection, going after al-Qaeda.
That's the case he's got to make. He fails. I mean, I think they've, in fact, backed off the argument that there is a direct tie between Iraq
the
and
Iraq. The tie aside. This, it's that they are part of a spectrum.
Right. And then he says, well, there's the possibility that they will transfer weapons to al-Qaeda. For my money, it's not Saddam's style to transfer weapons of mass destruction to people he can't control who don't like him very much.
On this timetable, he may not get a chance. We're talking tonight about Congress preparing to vote on war with Iraq. Is it time for Congress to vote yay or nay on war with Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Congress preparing sooner than many may have expected to vote on war with Iraq. There are hearings today in the House Armed Services Committee. Historic hearings will be followed by Senate hearings tomorrow on the need, in Donald Rumsfeld's urgent terms, for U.S. Congress to vote to give the green light to the Bush administration to take war to Iraq if necessary. Listeners, the question is, are the right questions being asked about casualties, about risks, duration, about rebuilding Iraq? Should Congress vote before the UN Security Council? Does Donald Rumsfeld, in his testimony, give you confidence or does it give you cold feet? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Stephen Van Evra. He's a professor of political science at MIT and author of Causes of War, Power and the Roots of War. We're also joined in studio tonight by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. The issue of what would come after was raised today by Representative Ike Skelton, Democrat of Missouri. Let's listen to his question and Donald Rumsfeld's reply on what comes after an effective war or war that unseats Saddam Hussein. What would come next?
What preparations are being made now for the administration of Iraq after Saddam falls, and for the longer-term transition to a more permanent government? The second part of the question is, what's the level of diplomatic and military commitment to be made to Iraq after Saddam falls, and particularly, what's the estimate of American troops needed to ensure stability for the first year or in the long term or both?
Congressman Skelton, that's, of course, an exceedingly important question, and it is one that the President and the National Security Council have given a good deal of thought to, as to whether or not the United States would have to make a military in the short run and a diplomatic and humanitarian and reconstruction effort in the longer term. The answer is yes. One would. One doesn't change what is without recommending something better. The difference between this and Afghanistan, however, is that this is a country that has large oil revenues. So from a financial standpoint, it is an easier problem for the international community than a country that has been devastated by decades of conflict and does not have oil revenues to help buoy it up and bolster its recovery.
Donald Rumsfeld before the House Armed Services Committee today, and Stephen Van Evra, in that reply, a big horizon opened up to my mind. Donald Rumsfeld saying Iraq is no Afghanistan. It has enormous oil reserves, i.e., Iraq can produce the cash for its own reconstruction. Therein seems to my mind to lie an enormous story. The Bush administration anticipating victory, control over oil fields, which are among the world's very largest, a cash gusher that they could then ride to rebuild Iraq. It certainly sounds much different than the nation of stone and caves, Afghanistan.
I think it's misleading. I think that he's suggesting that the only problem is cash. How do you pay for it? The real problem is political reconstruction. What kind of political order can we put in place in that country that will serve our interests and make sense for the region? And I'm having a hard time imagining what it is, and I'm having a hard time imagining that we aren't going to have to be intimately part of it for the duration. Key point to make is that we've proven very bad at getting out of countries that we occupy over the last 60 years. We're still in Germany 60 years later. We're still in Japan. We're still in South Korea. We said we'd only be in Bosnia for a year. We've been there now 7 years. No sign of us getting out. We're still in Kosovo. So how are we ever going to get out of Iraq? And the reason why it's so important to get out is, as I said, we're fighting a war on Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda wants to get at us. They want to use our presence in the Middle East as a rallying cry. They're going to certainly use our presence in Iraq as an occasion to go after us. Because remember, they're a fundamentally Arab organization. They can swim in the Iraqi Sea. We're exposing a flank to them. If we wind up sitting on that country, babysitting it, we're putting ourselves right where Al-Qaeda can reach us.
You put a lot on the table there. Let's go back to the top, the notion that it's not about money to rebuild Iraq. It's a political challenge. Give us the dimensions of that political challenge, and how do they compare with others you've cited, with Korea, with Kosovo?
Okay, there's two basic options. One is to democratize the country, put some democratic constitution in place, and then hope that that will hold, that democracy will set in, and we can leave a stable democracy in our wake. I think that's not going to happen.
Why not?
Because the country is very deeply divided between three national ethnic groups, the Kurds in the north, the Sunni Arabs in the middle, and the Shia Arabs in the southeast. And we found we're very bad at organizing democracies where divided societies share power. That's really why Yugoslavia fell apart. It began pluralizing, and you had groups there with great grievances against each other, and they fought. Soviet Union fell apart when it began to pluralize. There's countries in Africa that have fallen apart when pluralization began. So we think of democracy as a panacea, and I'm all for it in most conditions, but we shouldn't think it's going to work easily in Iraq. Then the other option is dictatorship. Let's find Mr. Musharraf, you know, the Iraqi version, and put him in charge. Mm-hmm. Trouble is there, we are viewed in the Arab world as having such dirty hands. We're viewed as an illegitimate player, an illegitimate actor. Maybe you think the reasons why we're viewed that way are unfair, but Arabs resent our support for Israel and so forth. They also, I think, wrongly accept the notion that we've been part of some kind of Western beating up on the Muslim world. I think it's based on falsehood, but it's widely believed. So any regime we install is going to have to answer charges that they're stooges, that they're American puppets, and they're going to be illegitimate. I find it very hard to understand how we are going to install a legitimate government.
Jack Beatty, can it be that the Bush administration is blind to these issues? Everybody knows about the ethnic divisions in Iraq, which will make even potentially the unity of the country difficult. Stephen Van Ever is saying it's not enough to tap into the oil wells and pave all the roads and build all the new factories. You won't have a political organism that will hold together here. Can the Bush administration just be ignoring that issue, or do they know something we don't?
I don't think they do know something we don't. They have had dealings now with the Iraqi National Congress and with other groups that have been in the opposition to Saddam. And as I understand it, these groups still haven't been able to get together. And these are groups that don't I'm not even sure that they follow the ethnic and religious lines. It's more that they just can't get together on political objectives. So that even the sort of government in absentia, or whatever you want to call it, even the resistance groups can't seem to get together on a common picture. And, you know, in his testimony, the secretary referred to the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998. He said that's the act that switched our policy from containment to regime change. But that act, which was a brainchild of Trent Lott and others, mm-hmm. was all about a proxy, using proxies to change the regime. And the proxies were going to be these dissident groups, the Iraqi National Congress mm-hmm. and so on. But they were spending money lavishly. They weren't getting together. They didn't seem to have any support there. So it's not as if, I mean, what we do know about the opposition and about people who say they are Democrats isn't very encouraging. Maybe they know something we don't. But just based on the evidence and on what the State Department itself has said about some of these Iraqi groups, it hasn't been a very pretty picture in terms of corruption and
we're talking tonight about Congress preparing to vote on war with Iraq. Is it time for Congress to vote, yay or nay, on this war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make 2 points. One was about the smoking gun issue. I've heard Rumsfeld comment that, you know, you need to act now because you don't want to suffer, you know, tens of thousands of lives before it's too late. And I guess my view on that is that, well, is he saying that, you know, stop now and save tens of thousands of lives mm-hmm. or, you know, go into Iraq and kill hundreds of thousands of lives, as is the precedent of the 91 Gulf War? And then the other point I wanted to make was that I actually think that there is an intermediate road that seems to I think would solve everyone's problems except for maybe Saddam. And that is, why not incrementally increase the no-fly zone so that you start to gradually impinge on Baghdad? If you look at the way the Kurds have succeeded under the no-fly zones, is it logical to assume that if you extend the no-fly zone so that other local populations within Iraq start to kind of throw off the shackles of Saddam and...
So just sort of surround and then tighten the noose. It already comes pretty close to Baghdad on the southern side, Imran. Do you think it would really make a difference to throw it over the Iraqi heartland?
Yeah, you know what, because, I mean, this is speculation, but I think that, you know, if people start to throw the yoke of Saddam on, and you basically limit Saddam to Baghdad, and, you know, maybe it's easier to have a regime change because now it's done by locals who basically don't have the fear of intimidation of Saddam. And getting to the point that, you know, about the factional fighting between the different groups, I think maybe what America could always say is that, look, we'll withdraw, you know, the no-fly zone back to the 45-degree latitude, and you can deal with Saddam unless you guys are willing to work it out yourself.
Imran, thanks for your call. Stephen Vinevra, two questions raised there. First, civilian casualties, likely civilian casualties, or overall casualties in a war with Iraq. Imran says Donald Rumsfeld doesn't want to see smoke coming from the gun and tens of thousands dead here or in the United States or in Israel or elsewhere. But what are we looking at in terms of potential casualties in a war with Iraq? Can it be surgical?
There are two big worries. One is our casualties, and we need to hear more about that. And the second is civilian casualties. We're going to do our utmost to prevent civilian casualties, but Saddam is going to do his utmost to force us to cause them because he's going to want to, you know, present a grim and grisly business on worldwide Arab TV. And the way he's going to go about it is by trying to suck us into urban warfare.
And can he succeed in that? Can he put us in a box where civilian casualties are inevitable in volume?
There's a lot of urban territory. Baghdad is a huge city. And if he prepares properly, which, you know, let's not assume he's a fool, and he invests in Baghdad, he stores a year's worth of water and a year's worth of supplies and fortifies the place and withdraws there and then won't let the civilians leave, we have a problem on our hands. You know, think Mogadishu. Think Mogadishu with even more civilians in the way. We're going to take some losses and we're going to look bad because we're going to hurt a lot of civilians.
And there was a Washington Post report some months ago, our friend Tom Ricks, who quoted people in the Defense Department saying that Saddam has put a lot of his defensive his defensive stands and some of his weapons laboratories. In other words, he's put a lot of his targets near mosques, hospitals, schools, all deliberately.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
What about our caller Imran's second point? Is there a way through air cover or otherwise to sort of effectively liberate larger and larger swaths of Iraq to kind of pull a noose around Saddam without going in to allow Iraqis to stand up and do it themselves? Is it fair to characterize the territory beneath the no-fly zones now as hospitable to opposition to Saddam? Or is he capable of being pretty heavy-fisted even on the ground alone?
Imran has a clever idea, but I don't think it'll work because Saddam can still police with a very heavy hand the territories that are under any no-fly zone that we create. Because his vehicles can still travel and his goon squads can still, you know, move about in the night and break arms and legs. Rebellion against a regime like this is very, very difficult and a dangerous work. And I think the only scenario whereby it will be overthrown locally is if there's a coup, okay? If we can find very brave souls in the Iraqi military who will overthrow Saddam. And we've tried and some of them have tried and they've all been killed. I'll also just add that the Bush administration looked at the scenario of trying to do this war through proxies, trying to mobilize the Iraqi National Congress and see if they could be armed in some way and become the leaders of a military effort. The so-called Afghan model method here, which would be supply
the Northern Alliance do it for us, the equivalent thereof.
Exactly. And they've abandoned that plan because it looks too hard. The Iraqis are too tough. The Iraqi army is 20 times the size of the Taliban. No rebel force that looks like it's got enough muscle to even play in the same ring with Saddam seems on the horizon. So we have to suck it up and realize there's no easy way out of this mess. If we want to overthrow Saddam, we're going to have to do it with the big battalions.
Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'd like to start by saying I have a problem with the characterization in the press, including NPR, that Donald Rumsfeld, quote, made his case to Congress today. All he did was read a bill of particulars, which is equivalent to an indictment. He offered no evidence. He made no case. And given the fact that Donald Rumsfeld, to any historian, if not a proven liar, is at least a proven exaggerator over years, to say he made his case is going too far. Now, in my opinion...
Well, he certainly made a case.
Well, did he make a case or did he read an indictment? I mean, he alleged a lot of things, basically on take my word for it, or we told you in private, but the public can't hear. To me, that's not making a case. Mm. To me, this is pure politics. George Bush discovered that he became suddenly popular by having a war. You could make the same bill of indictment against India, Pakistan, Korea. Indeed, you could make it against Israel. Weapons of mass destruction, attacking your neighbors historically, human rights violations. In my opinion, Saddam Hussein is just W. Strawman, and he's pushing, in a very political sense, give me a vote before the congressional elections. Don't wait for any process. Don't ask questions.
And do you doubt at this point, Jay, that he will get that vote?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I've certainly lost a great deal of faith in the Congress, but he won't get my vote, and he won't get my support, you know, I can only, ultimately in the United States, each citizen can only act for themselves.
Jay, thank you for your call and your observations. Jack Beatty, is it your sense that there's more fog around the beginning of this war? Jay, says there's no case made here. Is this the ambiguity that always surrounds war just before it begins? You know, the kind of untold stories, the backroom conflicts and deals and broken deals that always precede troops going into action? Or does this seem to be an extra unclear circumstance?
I think it's an extra unclear circumstance. I mean, we do not know the basic questions. We don't know Iraq's capabilities. We don't know this. This is what the inspectors would have to tell us. We don't know. People don't think. I think there's a consensus. He doesn't have nuclear weapons. Question is, how far is he from getting them? What would he have to do to get them? About his chemical and biological weapons, there doesn't seem to be much doubt. But the question is, how weaponizable are they? The question is, how can they be delivered? These are matters of intelligence and matters of, you know, spies and finding things out. This is the stuff the inspectors are supposed to find out. So I think that this take our word for it. I mean, take our word for it. Something that could get thousands of Americans killed, VA hospitals for the rest of their lives for the lucky. Who knows how many women and children, as Imran pointed out, in Iraq. This is a lot to say. Now, what did President Kennedy do? I've mentioned it before, but just to be brief, President Kennedy showed the photographs at the most absolute moment of peril the country has faced since World War II. Mm.
Here's the missile installation in Cuba. Here's the U-2 flyover shot.
And he rejected preemptive strikes. His brother said that would be Pearl Harbor in reverse. That's not what we do in the United States. And there were the missiles. Good thing he rejected that, too.
We're talking tonight about Congress preparing to vote on war with Iraq. Hearings today in the House Armed Services Committee. Donald Rumsfeld making his case, a case. You be the judge. Is it time for Congress to vote, yay or nay, on war with Iraq? Are 2 days of congressional hearings enough, or have we already heard enough? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Congress preparing to vote on war with Iraq. This morning, there were hearings before the House Armed Services Committee. Donald Rumsfeld was there. So was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, talking about, taking questions on, what an armed conflict with Iraq would entail. and Donald Rumsfeld urging Congress to vote and vote quickly to give the president a green light to go in militarily to Iraq before the U.N. Security Council has a chance to vote one way or another on a resolution on inspections or more. What do you think? Is it time for Congress to vote yay or nay on war with Iraq? Have we had a proper debate on this war? Too much? Too little? Are you ready for war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. There was a question raised this morning by Representative Mac Thornberry. He's a Republican from Texas, and he wanted to know about what were the chances and the readiness if Saddam managed to bring a war, the war, to this country.
I guess the primary question on my mind, and General Myers, I may direct this to you, is if the president decides to take military action in Iraq, are we ready? And in particular, are we ready to have forces in an environment where weapons of mass destruction may be used against them?
Congressman Thornberry, let me first say that the short answer is yes. The longer answer is over the past decade, and I would admit early in the decade, our capability to deal with weapons of mass destruction for our soldiers and sailors and airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, was uneven. But in the last part of this decade, for the majority of it, we have made very good improvements in terms of sensors that detect attacks, in terms of being able to net those sensors together to provide, you know, area warning for collective protection, and in the kind of protective suits that our troops wear. So we've made improvements in all those areas. And without getting into much more detail, obviously our forces prepare for that, they train for that, and would be ready to deal with that type of environment.
Representative Mac Thornberry, Republican from Texas, asking this morning about weapons of mass destruction. And I'm sorry, I mischaracterized that in advance. It was in his case, and we'll talk about another case, but in his case, asking about weapons of mass destruction potentially being used against U.S. troops on the ground in Iraq. And Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, responding that, yes, we are ready for that. Stephen Van Evra, do you have the same confidence in the short answer? Yes, we're ready.
What General Myers said fits everything I know about our readiness to deal with weapons of mass destruction attacks on our troops. Those who looked at our program say that the suits work well, that we've developed pretty good defensive countermeasures against any form of attack we might face.
Though this is assuming that we're talking biological or chemical, not nuclear, obviously.
Correct. However, I'm always worried about how things go on the battlefield the first time we try something. And this will be the first time our forces have ever faced this kind of attack. So I will be, you know, worried until the war is over, because there's no question I think Saddam is going to use he's going to attempt to attack our forces with chem and bio. These are very lethal agents if you don't deal with them properly. Now, good question is, there's two questions. One is, can he in fact reach us with these agents? The usual way you would distribute these agents is by artillery. And if we're clever, we can see to it that he's never close enough to us with artillery to put it on us. Mm-hmm. But that would be one, aspect of the urban scenario I laid out earlier, is to try to suck us in close enough to his forces so that he could use these sorts of agents.
Mm-hmm. One of the congressmen this morning went down a long laundry list of the volume of chemical and biological material that had been found by the UN inspectors over the number of years that they were active in Iraq. And he was making the argument that the inspections were not without their value, that in fact perhaps we should go in and have inspectors, because they had found thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of gallons of things that sounded quite horrible, including lots of anthrax and lots of I don't have the vocabulary in front of me even now, but lots of chemical agents as well.
VX.
And his argument was, should we have inspectors go in first to see what they can pull out of the Iraqi system, if in fact there are chemical and biological weapons there, to diminish the stockpile that would be used against U.S. troops? Does that make sense to you, Stephen Van Evra, or do we really have to make a choice one way or the other, inspections or military action?
It does make sense to me, and the second thing that inspections also serve is that he has a hard time developing these weapons when he's got to constantly keep his program loaded up in trucks and on the run. So it may be that he keeps cheating and retreating, but his programs develop more slowly if they've got this headache to worry about, inspectors jumping them. Although I do agree in the end with the Bush folks, which is you can't use inspections to disarm that country unless Saddam has an epiphany and decides he wants to disarm. In the end, inspections are a partial tool, and they can only uncover so much. And against a totally uncooperative regime, they can't promise disarmament. They can only promise harassment and a certain amount of ferreting and intelligence.
Which gets to the question of why he wants these. The other night I put forward the hypothesis that these may now be a wasting asset for him, that he's got everything he can get out of these weapons. He's got he had them to deter us, didn't work. He had them to be a big man in the Arab world. Well, he got that. But now that what had been something that was giving him something is now actually making him a target. So the question is, in other words, why has he had them?
Well, he also had them, of course, to fight the Iranians.
Yes,
let's remember,
right.
He lives in a very tough neighborhood, and he's got some nasty neighbors that don't like him. And these weapons prove crucial in beating back the Iraqi offensives in the later stages of the Iran-Iraq war.
With our help.
With our help, actually. We always like to point to his use of chemical weapons against Iran as a indicator of his heinousness. Let's remember that we green-lighted this. Our own folks gave him the intelligence.
Satellite photos that gave him the targets.
We showed him the attack that was about to be launched against him because we could see the Iranians massing, and we advised him on where to mass in order to deal with it. And we knew that he was going to use chemical weapons as part of his counterattack, and we didn't object. Rumsfeld was involved in that.
Martha's on the line. Welcome, Martha. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm very concerned about this resolution that reminds me of the Gulf and
Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
The Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1967 and the tremendous political pressure that was put upon the United States to back President Johnson at the time, despite the fact that we really didn't know what was going on. And I reread the story in Tip O'Neill's book, Man of the House, that he tells about his attitudes towards the Vietnam War and how his initial apprehension before that resolution gave way when he decided to support the president, and then he was briefed by the government and all the different reasons why we should be there, and he began to be a firm supporter of that decision. But at a certain point, he decided to, which is an interesting story, it was students at Boston College who persuaded him to be briefed by the other side, that he learned something that reminded me of what Jack Beatty just said about the we really don't know what the story is. We don't have the information. The information we're getting is nowhere near the quality that we've had with the Cuban Missile Crisis or in the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. And that story that Tip O'Neill tells is that once he decided to investigate the reasons that people were opposed to the war, he began to meet privately with CIA officials and government officials who, on the ground, thinking that they were speaking privately, told him their real opinions. And he, in particular, he tells the story of meeting with some top-ranking CIA officials who told him that their information was being was not even getting to the president, that the president's advisors, and he names the advisors, were presenting the information because
of course that process of illumination took years, and we all know what happened during those years. Martha, thanks for your call. Stephen Evra, the Bay of Pigs gets raised here, Vietnam gets raised here. Are they appropriate touchstones of comparison and concern?
Well, I think every situation is different and unique, and I think that Saddam with nuclear weapons and biological weapons does pose a greater danger and a greater problem than we saw in Vietnam or from Cuba. The question still is, what is the right way to deal with that danger? And I agree with Marsha. We want to have the debate fully and thoroughly now in advance before we authorize action, instead of finding out later that there were angles that we didn't think about and facts that we should have borne in mind before we acted. I was going to say, this question of our losses is a number of questions I still haven't heard the administration speak to. One is, are we prepared for a weapon of mass destruction attack in this country?
And that was raised today by at least one congressman, one of whom was representing the city of New Orleans and saying, in the entire city of New Orleans, we have only 18 chem bio suits and people trained to use them for 1 million people. He said that's probably more than you have in the entire state of Mississippi. You know, this is a hometown guy, a congressman, saying, if they bring the war here, are we ready to face it?
And this administration hasn't seemed activated on preparing this country to deal with that kind of danger.
How great is that risk?
I think that the risk is small because it's not Saddam's style to hand over powerful weapons to people he can't control. And he's a control freak. And an attack like this would involve him giving these weapons to agents that would then, disappear over the horizon, and he'd have to trust them to do what he wanted, or transferring them to others who would do it. And that's not his style. But you can't rule it out. He's going to be in a situation of extreme peril. We're going to be going for his head. And he may do very reckless things.
I couldn't help but note that when the congressman pressed this point, about why they only had 18 chem bio suits in New Orleans, the Secretary of Defense turned to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and said, and the aides there, and said, now remind me, is that the Department of Defense responsibility or the Office of Homeland Security's responsibility? An ambiguity in his mind that I was unsettled to see at that point after 9/11. I have news just in, Jack, that the Bush administration is now saying it will send a proposed resolution authorizing military force in Iraq to Congress tomorrow, on the very day of the Senate hearings on this front, moving.
Which gets back to the Tonkin Gulf resolution, and just as a matter of history, I mean, Bob Dalek, in his recent biography of Lyndon Johnson, points out that that was in fact decided on a fraudulent basis. The information that the Johnson administration gave to the Congress, it knew was wrong. We claim the attack happened on international waters. It did not. It happened within Vietnamese waters. We made other claims about the extent of damage to our ship. Not true. And the president deliberately and willfully misled the Congress and the American people, and to their everlasting credit, two senators, Wayne Morse and Ernest Greening, were the only ones who voted against that.
But of course, because it happened then doesn't mean it's necessarily happening now. There, Stephen Everett, as you say yourself, there are very worrying things going on out there and very, very different views on how to respond to them. Let's get one more call. Courtney's on the line. Welcome, Courtney. You're on the air.
Didn't think I had a chance to get in there. I just want to remind us of those women in that hearing room today. How courageous they were to be there.
These were two women who raised a sign. I think it said,
right,
"Inspections, not war."
They're there protesting before the body bags. And Matt, think back to the Vietnam War. It took a long time before the anti-war movement got moving, and that's the thing that alarms me.
But Courtney, Donald Rumsfeld, after they were removed by police, said that is an example of the freedom of speech we have in this country that is not enjoyed in Iraq. Is that part of a justification for going after Saddam Hussein?
I'm alarmed at how quiet we are, the opposition, the loyal opposition. And thank you very much for this great program tonight, because you give courage to us all.
Well, we're trying to look from all angles. And Courtney, thank you for your call. So here we are, a resolution perhaps in the hands of Congress, if not on the floor of Congress, tomorrow. Stephen Van Evra, have we done our homework as a nation? We've been talking about regime change for at least a year now. There has been a lot of talk over the months. Are we adequately talked out on this? Is it time to hit the go button?
I don't think we're beginning to be talked out on it. And, Jack points out the question of making sure you got the right data, that we have the facts that are relevant in front of before we make the decisions. I don't think we've even adequately debated the meaning of the data we do have. I think we need to continue to discuss the facts that we know to be the case about Saddam and ask if we're drawing the right conclusions from it. I don't, for example, agree with the Bush administration's characterization of Iraq as a non-deterrable country. Are they deterrable? I think the general pattern we've seen from Saddam, he's a murderous thug. He's a monster. But he's been deterrable when people have tried to deter him. We need to re-explore that question.
Stephen Van Ever, we are out of time. Thanks for joining us tonight. Stephen Van Ever is professor of political science at MIT and author of Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. Jack Beatty, resolution's coming. Off we go somewhere, maybe.
Yes, and I just hope that historians won't look back and said, where was the Democratic Party? Where was the loyal opposition?
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by UR.